Welcome to Our Voices, Our Future, the podcast where we amplify the voices driving change and equity within medicine and beyond. Brought to you by the Gender Equity Task Force, a committee of the American Medical Women's Association. We're here to challenge norms, break barriers, and ignite conversations that matter. I'm Megan Etze, and in each episode, we'll bring you candid discussions with leaders, changemakers, and advocates working to create a more inclusive and just world. No more silence, no more waiting. It's time to get our voices, our future. Today, we are welcoming Dr. Frances McGill. Dr. McGill began her career as a critical care nurse, then was accepted as one of 16 women in the second class of St. George's University School of Medicine in Grenada, West Indies. Her internship in internal medicine was in the Brigham, Watham, Brockton program in medicine at Harvard's Medical School, and she completed a residency in obstetrics and gynecology at Women and Infants Hospital at Brown University. Most of her career has been in academic medicine in New York and Grenada, with sabbatical leaves in the UK, combining clinical practice, leadership, teaching, research, and medical education. Positions include head and director of gynecology and medical student clerkship director at New York Academic Medical Centers. Later, she returned to St. George University as professor of clinical skills in obstetrics and gynecology. Now she is an emerita professor and currently works at part-time at a New York City health center. Throughout her career, she has participated in medical student and resident selection committees and in mentoring medical students, young physicians, physician's assistants, and nurse practitioners. She thanks the leaders of the Women in Medicine student organization at St. George University for inviting her to speak on bias in medicine. So first off, Dr. McGill, for those listening and not aware, can you tell us a little bit more about implicit bias and what this means?
Yes, Megan, thank you very much for inviting me to talk to you. Before I talk about implicit and explicit bias, I just want to give you a dictionary definition of bias. And bias, by the Merriam-Webster Pocket Dictionary, is defined as prejudice. And then I looked up prejudice. Prejudice is defined as damage, especially to one's rights, but particularly with respect to what we're speaking about today, is unreasonable attitude for or against something. So if we think about explicit bias is bias that we are aware of. And as human beings, there are things that we all just don't like. So we don't like certain colors, certain places, certain smells, certain foods, certain brands, and certain people. And so explicit bias is more a known bias against a group, and since we're talking about people, particularly against a group of people. So historically, if we look back into the 1950s, there was a lot of bias by white persons against black persons, so that the black people in America, particularly in the South, were segregated. They were not allowed to use the same bathrooms. They could not go into restaurants. They were delegated to the back of public transportation buses. They were not treated well at all. And even before that, there was a lot of violence against Black people by the slave owners. Similarly, Japanese immigrants in the United States at the time of World War II were taken from their homes and they were forced to live in camps in the Midwest. And so that was another explicit bias that were really against people of a culture or people with a color of skin. Now, implicit bias is a little bit different. We all, despite wanting to be very universal in our thoughts, we all have biases that are unconscious. So unconscious bias or implicit bias really dates back to primitive times when men were certainly not cultured, and the early humanity, if we look back, I guess, millions of years, were tribal with groups of people living together, and the main issue in their lives was foraging for food and protecting themselves from animals and from their enemies. Mm-hmm. And so in that culture, there was either a flight or fight mechanism, or defining people who were not in their group as either enemies, foes, or as friends. And so unfortunately or fortunately, that has existed in our contemporary brain, but it's really relegated to be very unconscious. And so implicit bias is an unconscious bias against anything. It can be against people's behaviors, can be against people's groups, and it is responded to by really a very fast response rather than a very thought out response. And as I was thinking this through more, it's like sometimes we even say something that comes to us and you look back later and you say, how did that come out of my mouth? What did I say? So I think that it's not only behavior, but it's sometimes how we see things quickly. And a lot of research has been done on this by police departments, because everyone is aware, particularly over the last many years, of police violence and police shooting people. And then it's found that the people really did not have an arm, or it's police of one color, particularly against people in our Black society. And what the psychologists have realized is that this is really implicit bias in police persons who feel threatened at a time by someone that they see as a perpetrator. And there's been research showing that somebody may have something in their hand that the police person thinks is a weapon and really it isn't. And they're working very hard on that. And so similarly, as we move on into our careers, we may have bias against people of color, people who don't look like us. We're always thinking that people think and act and do like we are, but we don't. So what I would like you to do is just take a minute or two, and I'm just going to be quiet for a minute, which is hard for me, and just think about some time in your life, how you've quickly responded to a new situation or an event that was unexpected or unplanned for you. So your very quick response, and then later on, when you thought about it, would you have thought about it differently? And we'll just stop for exactly 1 minute. There are many examples of implicit bias. The one that was brought up by the woman who trains physicians and other people in healthcare on bias, her name is Diana Lautenberger, and she brought up the example of Oprah Winfrey being in Europe, not dressed, not made up, wearing her sunglasses, going into a very expensive bag store and wishing to buy a bag that was on the top shelf, which cost $38,000, more than many people's salaries. And the clerk just started to not reach up for that bag, but suggest that she look at other bags, because that clerk made the judgment that this woman was not going to afford this ridiculously priced bag, and that she would be helpful in terms of not making her feel bad, but in terms of having something that was reasonable for her. And then another classic example, I just said to one of the medical students as I was preparing this, is, or to the young doctors, is how many times has the male patient called you nurse? So there's the implicit bias, and it's there, and nobody means it. We don't think about it. So that is what we're going to focus on today a little bit. And it's really very hard to actually pinpoint bias, but it's something that we have to be a little aware of. And it's that we should be seeing the world as they, not only as us.
Thank you, Dr. McGill. That's a great explanation. I think it sets us up well for this next question. So can you tell us how implicit bias like manifests in medical school admissions and residency matching?
Well, I think that there's a lot of issues in terms of the people who interview for medical students now and the people who interview for residents. Many times they're of a different generation, and the newer generation looks different than we look. They have tattoos that are now visible. When I was first teaching at St. George's University back in 2008, our chairman was adamant that anyone who had a tattoo going to the hospital had to be covered up. Well, that's probably no longer possible when I see how popular tattoos are. And some of them are very, very, very beautiful, although I'd be very afraid to have all those needles put in me. People now, we have transgender people who sometimes look very much the part of their designated gender by virtue of probably how they were born. But some people look very unisex and you can't tell exactly who they are. And we have more unisex names, and that is a new phenomenon. People have visible piercings. People have different color hair. So all of that just may make a little bit of implicit bias just by looking at where they went to school on their application form. If it was a school that you went to or you respect, may bring in some bias. The way they speak, do they speak well over the internet because everything is done over Zoom? Do they smile over the internet? Do they make good eye contact with you? I think that's all very difficult compared to a real life situation where you can go in, you can greet a person, you can smile. So there's lots of implicit things that could happen in medical school and in residency admissions. And later on in the questioning, we'll talk about how that can be mitigated. But what I wanted to do for the audience who may not be totally familiar with medical school admissions is just talk to you a little about that. It is an overwhelming process, both for the applicant as well as for the faculty who need to take time out because everything now is pushed on seeing as many patients as you can within a given period of time. There's very little academic time for physicians who work in hospitals and residency programs, and there's very little research time so that interviewing candidates is done within the fact of a very busy day. But for the candidates, the average American graduate from a college or university will apply to 18 medical school programs, and that is done through the AMCAS, American Medical College Selective Application Selective System, AMCAS. It is a rigorous application that the candidate has to fill out their demographics, including things about their family and their family finances. And one of the biases that I read about is that families of better means have a higher acceptance rate to medical schools compared to those who have lower incomes. Although students from lower income families can apply for financial assistance because each application to each school costs about $150 and the AMCAS application overall is $348. So we're talking about a lot of money. But if we're looking at people who come from socioeconomic less positive situations, the application for the loan assistance is also very arduous, and many of the students don't know about that. After the student's application is screened, because they also have to fill in every course that they took, every grade that they took, every school that they attended, personal statements, and I'll talk to you about a personal statement later on, medical college admission test scores, and the MCAT is a standard test that needs to be taken by most medical school applicants, unless they're in a special combined college and medical school program. And the cost of that is, it's costly. Applicant, if they are looked at as being somebody that the school would like, then they often have to fill out a secondary application, and that is may have a fee again, and they may have to answer multiple questions or write another essay. And this is not uniform across the board with the American medical schools. So the process is very arduous, and I talked to you about how arduous it is also for the faculty. One of the things that the medical schools look at is looking at healthcare background. And some of the students feel compelled to do what's called shadowing physicians, where they will spend time in a physician's office or with a physician in the hospital, just following that person around. And some of the students believe that there's so much weight put on this from the medical schools that they will spend hundreds, if not 1,000 hours doing that. And some of them will actually take a gap year, so a year after college or university, to apply to medical school. And there was just recently an article that came out talking about how that also adds arduous issues to the medical student, and that healthcare experience, meaning maybe being a scribe, where the student will join an organization, learn about the electronic medical record, and assist the physician in putting in the patient information so that that student is with the physician observing what the physician does. Or perhaps being a medical assistant where they can get some payment, or perhaps being part of a research group doing some of the technical things that are involved in research grants would be all beneficial. Now, in my day, when I was applying, I worked at a university hospital in an open heart critical care unit. So I was doing very high level nursing, spoke to the dean at that medical school, and he said, "We don't want any of you people who have any background. You all have bad habits." And so, therefore, I was fortunate enough to be accepted into St. George's University. And I have to tell you, my grades weren't perfect. I partied and I went to school and I worked full time. So my grades weren't perfect, but they were acceptable. A lot of the people in my class were of healthcare backgrounds. We had nurses, pharmacists, physical therapists, respiratory therapists, PhDs, because the U.S. system didn't want them. The U.S. system now is looking at more global candidates and looking for people who have done other things with their lives and other things to demonstrate that they understand the healthcare professions, particularly medicine.
So can you tell us, are there particular demographic backgrounds and groups that are disproportionately affected by bias in the medical school admission process?
Well, when we look at the data, we look at medical school admissions. Classically, women were not accepted into medical schools. And then in 1849, Elizabeth Blackwell, who was an immigrant from the UK at age 11, wished to go to medical school. She applied to the US. The schools were all male candidates, and she was rejected and rejected. And then she was finally accepted to Geneva Medical School, which was upstate New York and is no longer in existence. Her sister had the same issues, finally was accepted. And these women started a hospital in New York to take care of women and children. And so they were the people who first opened the doors to medicine. There was a lot of prejudice also against people of color, particularly women of color. And in 1864, Rebecca Lee Crumpler, also a nurse, applied to medical school. And she was applying because she was so concerned about the prejudice against both women and African American people. And she attained admission. So she started to open the door to women of color. If we look back into the earlier data from the American medical colleges, 45 years of data, in 1980 to 81, which is when I graduated, but that's when the data 45 years was collated, there were 36,000 applicants for medical school, of which 26,000 were men and 10,000 were women. So in the 1981 class, of this total that was accepted, 49% of the applicants, 17,000 people were accepted into medical school. That was 12,000 men, who comprised 70% of the class and 46% of the applicants. and 5,000 women, which were 50% of the female applicants, but only 30% of the class. If we move forward now to contemporary times in 2004-2005 applicant class, there were 52,000 applicants, of which 24,000 were admitted. This is 10,000 men, so 49% of the male applicants, but interestingly, 42% of the class. And now the women applicants, because the door has been opened by these ladies as well as by those of us who went to medical school in the earlier years, of the 30,000 female applicants, 14,000 or 47% of them were accepted, and this was 58% of the class. So for about the last 20 years, the women medical class, the women medical students have been 50% or more in the classes. Now, one of the problems as we move forward looking at this is that they are now applying to competitive residencies, which are in general surgical residencies. But when women come out as physicians, and most physicians now are employed, their salaries are about 75% of what their male counterparts are earning. So that is a big discrepancy, and that I'm sure will be addressed by another forum at AMWA. Classically, women have, because they might be interested in childbearing, and also because their interpersonal skills are so good, and that's been shown in much of the literature. Classically, women have been accepted into residencies that they're interested in, and that is family medicine, internal medicine, pediatrics, and those specialties, because they're not procedure-oriented, also have earned less income, but that have been also a little more flexible, perhaps in terms of helping women to have their childbearing and have their child-raising years.
So can you
look at underrepresented people? If we look at the contemporary statistics, we looked at applicants from 2000 to 2002. And the data shows that looking at American Indian and Native, called Native Americans and Alaskans, that about 44% of those people achieved admission to medical school. And the overall acceptance rate of all of the cultural groups is about 45%. But when we look at Asian Americans, their acceptance rate is 49%. If we look at whites, which is the largest group, their acceptance rate is 43%. If we look at Hispanics, their number of applicants is less, but they had a 38%. Hawaiian and Pacific Islanders had a 38% acceptance, and I wonder why that is so low. If we look at Hispanics, their rate is 42%, so a little bit lower, maybe not statistically significant. But when we looked at Black and African American applicants, there were 4,700, of which 1,600 were accepted, and that is a 34% acceptance rate. And when I looked at the data, their MCAT scores were lower and their grade point averages were lower. So that is an issue that we really need to look and try and help the students of the African American background. If we look at international students who are first generation now in America, they comprised 14% of the applicant pool, but their admission rate was 11%. So this is another group that needs assistance. And one of the problems with these two groups is that because they come from less affluent cultures and less affluent societies, that they may not have the mentorship. They may not have the higher level schools that they've gone to. They may not have pre-med committees in every institution, and they may not have people in their families who have gone to college or to higher education who can assist them. And so these are people that we need to focus on to make our classes more diverse.
Yeah. So can you tell me how holistic review processes have improved diversity in medical school admissions, or do these biases kind of still persist?
Well, I think that all of the schools now are seeking more diversity. Schools that had been primarily white Christian males then accepted women, and now there are more Asian students in the classes. There are more people of color in the classes. There are more people who speak diverse languages in the classes. Unfortunately, under the new leadership in America, we no longer can have DEI noted anywhere. So the class needs now to be diversified in a different way. And so one of the things that's important for the candidates, both in medical school and in residency, is when you're writing the personal statements, is do not recapitulate your grades and things like that. Do not write, I want to be a gynecologist, which I am because I had painful periods when I was young. I've seen that on people's personal statements. Talk a little bit about yourself. What I hear resident application candidates saying is, we read on the internet that we shouldn't write anything that is in the application itself. Now, the application is at least 8 pages. And as I said to you, people are very busy. So we're not going to go through 8 pages of looking for what did that student do so we know how to talk to them. So put something about yourself. I grew up in this, my motivation was whatever. Yes, maybe your grandmother was sick and that encouraged you as a child, but we need one sentence on that, not a whole treatise. Talk about what you did, what your culture was. I came from this kind of a background, and what struggle did you overcome? What is your motivation to do medicine? What makes you different from another candidate? And if you've been like an Olympic star or a fighter pilot or something that's on the front on your application, please put that in your personal statement, because that's what we look at and that's what we talk to you about during interviews, and that's the way you sell yourself. So I think that the schools are still trying to diversify the classes. What we know is we know that patients want to be taken care of by people who look like them. I guess in a sense, it's reverse implicit bias. But I was just at a gala for the clinic that I work in, which is inner city in New York. And there were a number of guests there. And one of the guests was the childhood friend of the man who's a CEO, a Hispanic man who was discouraged by his college professor, but then continued on and came back to the clinic that he attended as a child and now is doing a wonderful job. And one of the guests said, I had some spicy food and I went to my private physician who is in New York City in one of the upscale neighborhoods. And I told him I just had indigestion, but it's gone on for a long time. So he gave me some antacids and sent me home. He said, and then I started feeling a little bit worse. So I called my friend, the man who's the CEO of this clinic, and I said to him, do you have a black cardiologist for me? He said, we just hired one. He went to the black cardiologist. He was listened to, and he went from that office to the hospital where he had 4 stents placed in his heart. So it just shows that there still is implicit bias in terms of culture and how people talk to people. We don't know what exactly this patient really said to the doctor. We don't really know exactly what the doctor said to the patient. But there is a big need for diversity in the medical school classes. And we know that if they cater to people in their own culture, that those people are very appreciative.
So how would you say that interviewers' unconscious preferences affect the way that applicants are evaluated?
Well, we try very hard on admissions committees, and I've been on admissions committees at a major U.S. institution, an international institution, and I've sat on residency selection committees probably since we were residents, so on multiple. And what all of those committees have is they have standards for the interviewers. And in general, the interviewer will grade the candidate objectively on a standardized form that all of us share, and that is a numerical grade. So it's like a Likert scale or some verbal standardized responses to the candidate, evaluating everything in the candidate or evaluating just the interview depending on where you are and how your committee is formed. So that having standardization between the evaluators should overcome some of the implicit bias. If we know, for example, that Megan says, oh, I like her because she went to the same school as me, and I know that those students are good because I'm very good, we will say, Megan, the director of the admissions committee should take Megan aside and say, we have to be objective, not go on happenstance. Those things happened in the past. I think they're happening less. Now, if a student appears to be problematic in the interview, then maybe they can be offered a different interviewer. Or in one of the committees that I work, the students are interviewed by 8 different people in one afternoon, which is quite arduous for the students. But when you think that there are 8 evaluators, if one evaluation is off kilter, then maybe it's the interviewer. If 6 or 7 of those evaluations are off kilter, then maybe it really is the student that would not be a fit for our school. So I think that people are trying very, very hard to have the format be objective and have the evaluation be objective, but it should be a conversation. We want the students or the resident applicants to be talking to us, not just going through, okay, I have to say this now, so I'm saying this, and this is what I have memorized. We want to understand you as a person, see if you fit, evaluate your communication skills. We've already seen your academic skills, otherwise you wouldn't be getting the interview.
So why would you say it's crucial to address these implicit biases?
Well, I think it's crucial to address it so that we can have objective evaluation of students and so that we can hopefully accept students and physicians into our medical school and into our residency who will fit in our programs, who will excel in our programs, and who will be very good academically and interpersonally with the patients that they take care of and be credit to our institution when they finish.
And so how can admissions and residency committees hold themselves accountable to have these fair selection processes?
Well, I think that we just discussed this because all of us have been trained in implicit bias. All of the committees will have meetings before the interview sessions or periodically going over the standards that are expected. And I think everyone is constantly updated on those standards. And the other thing that I think goes across the board is if the interviewer personally knows the student, he or she must refrain from interviewing that student or making a judgment on that student, because you'd probably be prejudiced either for or against.
So Dr. McGill, can you tell us just lastly here, what advice do you have for applicants from underrepresented backgrounds navigating through these challenges?
Well, actually, I think my advice is for everyone. And that is to be as believing in yourself that you can do it. Find a mentor who believes in you. All of us have been told, no, we couldn't do it or we shouldn't do it. So find somebody who believes in you. If you are in a school where there's a pre-med program and they have an advisor, once you finish, sometimes it's hard to keep that relationship up, but you can certainly explore that. If you are not successful the first time, then try again. Study very hard when you're in your undergraduate or your medical school. Study very hard. Pay attention to the books or articles or whatever kind of handouts are given by the instructors. Do not rely on the senior students who say, oh, you don't have to read that because it's too much work. Just do the question book or just do the little mini book. Doing practice questions is very good, But you need to do it after you've learned the material, not use the practice questions and the answers in the book as a way of learning material. That is not a way to learn to be a pre-med student. You need to get the process of how to think through things down before you take your MCAT. And it certainly is not a way to learn medicine. For undergraduate students who may be financially disadvantaged, there are Pell Grants, or at least there are, I think, at the moment. We don't know what is going to happen with the American administration as it is now. But Pell Grants are federal grants that are for undergraduate education. They usually do not have to be paid back, but it's dependent on family income, so there is a complicated application procedure. Federal grants are usually available at least for secondary, tertiary education for medical schools. And again, it depends on the financial status of the applicant and the family. There are some other ways that you can skirt around the cost of medical school. Some of the schools now are becoming three-year programs, so you have very little summer vacation, but you finish after 3 years instead of paying 4 years of tuition. That's very good. Because in the fourth year of medical school, classically, that has been a year of what we call electives. So the student has finished their core rotations. They'll do things that they may not have learned, or they'll do rotations in specialties that they would like to apply to so that the people at those institutions have seen them. So we have to see how that going to a three-year school plays out. But I've had some experience with it. And for the candidates who know exactly what goal they have, it has worked out pretty well. In New York City now, at the New York University School of Medicine in Manhattan and the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx, those schools are tuition free. They have been very graciously funded by benefactors. There also is a Uniformed Forces School of Medicine based in, I think, Bethesda, where you can apply like other applicants. Certainly a little advantage if you've been in ROTC or you've been in one of the paramilitary careers, but you can apply and there is no tuition for that. You actually get paid a small stipend, but when you come out of that school, you must serve in the military forces, and that is not your choice, nor is where you're deployed to 100% your choice. So there are ways to do those things. What I would say is study, study, study. Take time for yourself, a little time off on Saturday or Sunday, and do your best in your courses and your best on your examinations. And I want to thank you very much, Megan, for inviting me. It's been very lovely and very nice to speak to all of you who listened, and I hope I didn't talk too much.
Thank you so much, Dr. McGill. This has been a great discussion full of valuable information. That's a wrap on this episode of Our Voices, Our Future. We hope today's conversation inspired you, challenged you, and reminded you of the power of raising your voice. The fight for equity doesn't stop here. Join us in the movement. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you love this episode, share it with someone who needs to hear it. Until next time, stay bold, stay vocal, and keep the conversation going. This is Our Voices, Our Future.